So as we built our financial model to justify it, we assumed there would be increase in churn because naturally as people are being charged more, they may not convert or they might churn. And there was almost no impact on churn.
Yo, mic check. What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Street Pricing Podcast, the only show where proven SaaS leaders share their mindset and mistakes in pricing so we can all stop guessing and start growing. Enjoy, subscribe, and tell a friend. Now, let's break it down with your host and sought-after slayer of bad pricing, Marcos Rivera.
What's up and welcome to the Street Pricing Podcast. I'm Marcos Rivera, author, founder, and pricing coach. And today, I have one of the hardest working guys in SaaS joining me to have a big discussion. It's going to be a lot of fun here. He is the co-founder of Pricing SaaS, John Kotowski. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Marcos.
No, I'm excited to have you today, man. You have so much data at your fingertips. I can't wait to get into it. But first, just give everybody a quick, in short, a little bit about you and what you do.
I'm the co-founder of Pricing SaaS, which is a data and content company. We basically track and monitor thousands of pricing pages, and we turn it into content, and we share it for everyone to really consume and learn more about pricing. In terms of my background, I have product management background. I did product management for well over 20 years, half of it as an IC, as an individual contributor, and half of it as an executive, as a head of product. And that's where I really fell in love with pricing. I realized the potential of pricing and monetization while I was leading product teams. And when I realized how powerful it is when you combine product initiatives and pricing and how much impact you can have on company growth, amazing, amazing things have happened. So after I've decided to go off on my own and I really wanted to focus on pricing, I feel like there's a big gap in the market. So here I am today.
Man, and I'll say this. This is probably why we connect so well, right? Because I discovered the power of pricing while I was a PM or product manager too, building value, trying to figure out how to get folks to sell it, to buy it. And it was such a powerful lever. I fell in love with it as I was moving in my career. And this is where I am now, right? Very, very deep into it. You know what? I do remember, I think it was Dan Martell who introduced us a few years back. Is that true?
That is correct. That's Dan Martell popped by one of our offices in Toronto one time. And he sort of like flew in with a bunch of founders. We talked shop for a while. So that's how I got to know Dan. And that's how I got to know you, Marcos.
All right. Shout out to Dan doing all the great things he's doing here. All right, guys. So here's what we're going to do. I wanted to break down a little bit of the show and what we're going to talk about, because I'm going to adjust it a little bit for you, John, just because of all that data you have at your fingertips. I want to get into it. So this show is really based on the book Street Pricing. And so I structure it in a rewind, play, fast forward. Where rewind, we talk about a story in the past, play, what's working now, fast forward, let's talk about the future trends. So in the rewind portion, let's talk a little bit about, you've seen pricing and you've done it as a product person. So let's get into a pricing story, success or struggle. We just want to know what you learned from it, because all of us out there are still in learning mode in SaaS and trying to figure this stuff out. It's a little scary. We need to unpack it. And I love your line. Pricing is hard. We just want to make it easier, right? And so that's a big thing there. And then when we move on to play, this is where I want to take a little bit of a shift and talk about the things you're seeing in all these pricing models or pricing page changes that you're tracking that's out there. I know some trends are coming out and bubbling to the top. Let's talk about what's changing on these pages. And then in the fast forward portion, I want to get a little bit into some of your recent stuff on pricing AI and the trends there. That's going to be one of the biggest, I think, intriguing topics in pricing, especially in the software game, as AI begins to flex its muscles and stretch. So let's get into that piece. Are you ready to get street with me?
Let's get started.
Awesome. Let's get started. Let's unpack a quick story, John. Go ahead.
So I'll talk about my experience at Format. Format is basically a website builder for creative people. So they compete with Squarespace, a typical website builder, but with templates specifically for photographers, artists, etc. I was there for 3 years as head of product. That was my last full-time gig. 50,000 customers, so lots of customers, no salespeople. Everything was product-led growth, self-serve, average transaction $12 to $15 per month. And when I joined, it was interesting because I joined as a product leader, but at the same time, because we didn't have a sales team, the CEO at the time said, "Hey, John, your bonus, your comp is tied to revenue targets. So you actually have a sales quota. It was okay. This is interesting, but it was really interesting in the sense that it forced me to think about monetization from the get-go. So as I was planning my quarterly roadmap initiatives, I knew at the beginning of every single quarter which initiative is going to drive revenue, additional revenue. And to be honest, Marcos, you know, a lot of it came down to how we did pricing and packaging. Some of it involved increasing prices. Some of it involved introducing new plans, bundling certain features. But we had it down to a science where, you know, like we could forecast revenue with probably 90% accuracy within, you know, like within a quarter or two. So it was really good. The biggest challenge was just coordinating the changes among so many customers. When you have 50,000 customers, a lot of them are on old plans. So grandfathering is a big issue. Logistics, coordinating with, you know, all the customer success representatives. And we had multiple projects. My team used to hate it because we had so much complexity in the projects, but at the end of the day, we pulled it off. So again, like the biggest challenge wasn't necessarily the changes themselves, just managing the complexity of the project when so many customers are involved.
Yeah, and then the 50,000 you said right in that base, that's quite a bit. But that means that population also has probably some differences in them if you were to break them up into cohorts, not just in what they're paying, but what they're using. And I think that's a big key in trying to step back and think. And so when your CEO said, "Hey, you got a sales quota now," which I think is it's a brilliant approach actually to get incentives aligned.
I think about it, right? I think it is. Yes.
I was like, "Well, maybe we should think about that more often." But one thing that's when that happened, you were probably like, "Oh, okay, something changed." Now that you have a sales quota or a component of your success is based on that, and you knew pricing is a big lever, what was the first thing you did? When that change came into place, what was the first pricing change you did, if you could remember?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of it was just getting my hands on the data and really understanding how revenue changes. So you know, because it was such a large number of customers, we used homegrown tools. We ended up adopting ChartMogul, which is an analytics tool for SaaS companies. It helps you analyze MRR metrics such as churn, expansion, contraction. So we got really, really good. I got really good at ChartMogul, the tool, understanding the movements, the churn, the expansion opportunities. And then furthermore, to your point, Marcos, breaking it down into different segments as well as cohorts. Because when you have so many customers, you can actually start dividing it up and treating those segments differently. This is where a lot of the complexity came in because we identified certain segments that we wanted to experiment with or potentially, you know, create certain buyer journeys, which again, like introduced complexity. A lot of the systems we used at Format, this is like six years ago, were homegrown tools. So we didn't have, like right now in the market, there's a lot more in terms of like pricing and packaging toolset, billing tools out there that help you manage this complexity. Everything for us was homegrown. So literally we had to go through scripts. We had to go do all kinds of data analysis to see again, like who would be affected. We wanted to make sure, you know, like nobody so like gets charged the wrong amount or they don't get access to certain features that they shouldn't be accessing. So just managing the complexity. But again, like when you have so many users, you can do so much in terms of segmentation and how you create the, you know, even an upgrade path. It's like, okay, I know somebody is using this certain feature. I want to introduce them to the plan that consists another feature that will sort of like be a natural extension to what they're doing. So we did a lot of these experiments and exercises, but again, like it's just the complexity of managing this whole thing. A lot of it was human based. Luckily, I had one of the best teams in the world. So again, like we managed to pull through it. But again, like it was so much work, manual work, just to manage the whole thing.
Yeah, because everything is homegrown, right? So you had to do all this stuff, boots on the ground with your own hands. You know, building events to try to see like the right transactions and all these key things. And from time and time again, I'd love to know that these things are often harder than people think. And if you think they're hard, it's probably a little harder than you think. But when you are able to kind of start seeing some of the fruits of that analysis and labor and information, when was that turning point for you guys?
To be honest, Marcus, you know, like when you're delivering, when you're growing revenue, and you know, like you're hitting your targets, and you say you'll do something, you actually get there, you get a lot of respect. So as a product leader, you know, like as I started delivering and hitting my targets and growing revenue, I got more and more autonomy. So again, like a lot of people trusted me. You know, I remember our CFO literally said, "Hey, John, do you need more budget?" He was literally willing to give me more budget because, again, like he saw that there's a lot of growth coming out of the product team compared to the marketing team, for instance, right? So again, like as a product leader, I think, you know, like this is one of the superpowers you can acquire. If you get good at pricing and monetization, that will literally set you apart from like 95% of the other product leaders that are out there. It is such a superpower.
I can attest to that, absolutely. And the fact that they actually want to give you more budget, which is the exact opposite of what a lot of people are wondering, like, how the hell do I get more budget, not less? I love that. And I think you're right. I think once you have some wins, and this is the thing that I'm picking up, and you can tell me, Marcos, that's not the point, but I picked it up anyway, which is you got to break it down and maybe, you know, get a small win under your belt, get something out there, get going, and then build on those small wins and go continue to get bolder and bolder. And I think just that first small win is always the toughest because it requires the most work. But once you build momentum, it starts to get a little bit clearer and easier, right?
And there's such a wide degree of, so like, monetization initiatives you can do. Some of them are very, very risky. You know, changing prices is always very risky. People are always scared of changing prices. But, you know, like even little things like, you know, creating add-ons. So we, one of the first things we did is we created domain add-ons. So you purchase a website, you get a domain for $20, or, you know, it's included if you subscribe for a year. That was a very low risk, and it had tremendous benefits because when somebody attaches a domain to their website, it's such a cumbersome process. The likelihood that they will churn and leave goes down by like 80%. Once you sort of like configure DNS and you attach a domain to a website, chances of you taking that to Squarespace or another competitor are very, very low. So we created like a double monetization mechanism. One is if you subscribe on a monthly basis, we would sell it to you as an add-on for $20. Or include it for free if you signed up for an annual plan, which improved retention, which again had impact on MRR. So that was sort of like an easy initiative that we did. Ultimately, again, like once we started getting those little wins, we started sort of like getting more empowered. We were like, okay, now we're going to introduce a new plan. We're going to increase prices. I remember right before we got acquired, we increased prices, and I think it was like 25%. Part of it was because we wanted to increase revenue before we got acquired. But the point of the story is we assumed the churn would go up quite a bit as a result of that price increase. And we had that built into our projections. And there was almost no impact on churn. Almost no impact in extra 25%.
Say that one more time, because I think this is a big fear for people. I just want you to say it again.
We knew we were hiking the prices up by a large amount, 25%. So as we built our financial model to justify it, we assumed there would be increase in churn because naturally as people are being charged more, they may not convert or they might churn. And there was almost no impact on churn.
Almost no impact on churn. And you said 20, this is not a 2% price increase. We're talking
this is like 25% increase.
Oh, I love that. 25% increase. Hardly any churn, but I bet you your model assumes some and you perform better than your model.
Absolutely. That was a huge win. I wasn't there, you know, I was there for another 6 months after. And again, like the churn or the retention persisted, like it was still good. 3 years later, maybe some of those annual customers have experienced higher churn, but again, like initial results were amazing.
Oh my. And I imagine like this space. At that price range, the $12 to $15 kind of month payment, I mean, the price sensitivity is a little different than if you're, spending $150,000 on something, right? So the changes and the thoughts. So you just gave me an idea for a new framework, just right now in real time. You break it down, you make a bet, and then you go bold, right? So you do it in these three steps, right? Get the data, break it down, look for the opportunities. Let's take a small bet and let's just keep making bets after that. And then you start getting bolder after that one.
That's exactly what we did at Format, and it worked. It worked
all right.
So well.
I just took everything you said. I just put it in three B's. That's all I did. Nice. That's how I think. But that was a fantastic story. I think a lot of folks in thinking about and just listening to you realize that you can change the structure, take a small, easy thing like the add-on, and by the way, charging for it on a monthly versus giving to them for the annuals, genius way to give them the incentive. You don't always have to charge money for everything. You can use it to leverage to get something else, which then ultimately leads to higher LTV or higher ACV. So I think you played it really smart here. The big takeaway for everybody, like if you go, as you reflect on that time at Format, like the biggest lesson for folks before we move on.
If I was to do it all over again, everything again, like worked out really, really well. I think investing in good tooling and infrastructure will pay off in huge dividends. Because again, like as you create this list of initiatives or like potential monetization experiments without good infrastructure, you're going to get bogged down in details and it will slow you down. So like upfront investment in good infrastructure is a must.
I think that probably would have helped ramp in the beginning of this whole journey if you would have had that tooling in place. It makes tons of sense here. And nowadays, there's more and more options than ever. Every day, so if you look back 5 years ago, 10 years ago, there's like really not a lot of options for tooling for monetization. There's a ton going out there now. So take a look, make sure you have the right data investment tools. Make life easier for yourself and make pricing easier for yourself by doing that. I think that's a solid point.
Yeah, there are tools for feature flagging, planning configuration, pricing, billing. There's a lot of options out there. So again, I think if I was to do it again, I would evaluate them, put in the framework, and then again, keep going with the initiatives.
Yeah, and I also think PLG and usage-based and AI, these are pushing the limits of some of these things, and that's where you're seeing even more capabilities now than ever, right?
That's right.
100% on that one, man. Team, I want to take a quick pause here to ask you for a huge favor that'll mean a lot to me. Please review and share the show. Share it with your team, your friends, your peers. Not only will it help them stop the guesswork in pricing, but it'll also help you and increase the chances that you'll take action and change for yourself. All right. Much love. Now back to the show. Want to move on to a topic I know you're dying to talk about. So let's go into the play, right? We run a play. You are looking at, you probably look at more pricing pages than anybody out there, right? And I look at a lot, right? So you must be looking at tons. You have to tell me, man, there are probably trends that you're picking up on of how companies are changing their pricing page, right? And I want to touch a little bit about the whole publish, don't publish, because there's, you see that shift in and out of vogue. Some companies, they go and they publish and then they turn around and then they take it down and they publish again, right? So we'll get on that piece a little bit later. But just in general, man, what trends are you seeing pricing page, good or bad? What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, so I can speak to some of the freshest data that's out there, which is, again, like data that I've been working on this week. So I'm working towards our next benchmark report, which is looking at around 450 companies that do have public pricing pages that we've been tracking for about a year and a half. For this report, we're looking at data for 2024. So any changes that occurred since January 1st. The first thing that I'm looking at is pricing changes. Everybody wants to know who's changing prices. The first, probably like biggest insight for me is how many companies do not change prices? So about 23% out of the 450 changed their price this year so far, which is crazy if you think about it, Marcus, because that means over 3/4 of companies have not adjusted their price points, which is absolutely crazy because, again, like if you think about inflation alone, they're not even adjusting for inflation. I'm a landlord. I do this to my tenants all the time. Like every year, I raise rent. These two keep up with inflation. But over 3/4 of companies out there haven't increased or adjusted their prices this year so far, which is, I think is wild.
That is wild. You're not saying half. You're saying 3/4. So that's 3/4. Most are leaving it steady. And I wonder if it had anything to do with, the economic uncertainty and some of the turbulence there. That's a big number.
Yeah. I mean, it could be a number of reasons. One is, you know, like, I think fear is one of them. I think companies are afraid to increase or change prices in the fear that, you know, as soon as they send a notification to the customer, they'll be like, okay, do we really need that SaaS tool? So they may, they fear that customers will churn as soon as they touch pricing. The other one could be infrastructure. Changing prices is not easy. You have to adjust all the billing systems. You have to communicate it to the customers. Again, it is a project. And, you know, like part of it could be like just, I don't know, laziness or lack of skills or expertise. Again, like, or maybe even lack of ownership, as you probably know, Marcus, like pricing is one of those disciplines that typically doesn't have a dedicated owner within a company unless they get really, really big. So again, like sometimes it just falls through the cracks because the CEO or the founder who used to do pricing is now too busy growing the company. So nobody really owns pricing. So it's, you know, like, let's leave it as it was because it's always worked for us. So again, like that's one of the biggest insights is like most companies haven't touched pricing so far this year.
Breaks my heart every time, man. Every time. No, the reason I say this because I know they're working hard in the background, building, adding more capabilities to their roadmap, to their infrastructure. They're getting faster and smarter, and they're not capturing that hard-earned value they're putting in there. And you're right. I think it's usually fear that sales will slow down, customers will churn. It's a lift. Nobody has the time and energy to do it because we're all running so hard, so fast, and doing more with less. And like, who has all this free time to dig into the data and do pricing and manage that change all the way through, right?
Which is crazy, right? Because you know, like, it's so easy to justify, right? Oh. You know, like, you invest the time to do a project like this, and you know, like, you can increase your overall revenue by 10, 15, 20% easily without, you know, like, without too much effort compared to some of the other initiatives that you take on, right? But I don't have to, I'm preaching to the choir.
You don't have to twist my arm, my friend, right? I mean, it is the fastest ROI value creation you can do. Coming from somebody who did creation for a living for tons of companies, right? It was the fastest and quickest. It was the quickest. And it also, by the way, led to the highest impact. So if I hired a sales rep, that would add some ROI and add some revenue, but you got to have the hiring, you got the ramp up, the training and all that before they're fully productive rep. You're looking at 6 months or so plus all that cost. A pricing change going into play, not just new business, but also on the base can lead to very fast ROI.
Especially the base, right? Because it's all of your existing customers times whatever change you've made. So if you increase price even by, you know, 10%, that's an extra 10% in revenue minus the churn.
You're saying it right, exactly right. The CAC or the acquisition cost of that revenue is so much cheaper, flows to the bottom line. There's lots of good reasons to do it. Obviously, it's it's something that you want to put thought and handle carefully, right? Which is where we strike the counterbalance on that. But the point here is that it's a way to capture more value and boost the top line. I think where companies get a little nervous is, again, like the implementation, the execution, all those key things. But it's always worthwhile. So when someone asks me, Marcus, should we hire a pricing lead? And they're like, you know, an $80 million company with 7 products. I'm like, yeah, you absolutely should.
No problem.
And even sooner than that, right? I mean, it's one of those things where there's always ROI in that. So we see eye to eye on that one. Any other big change you're noticing? And so the big change is nobody's changing, but what's the other one you see?
So even within that, you know, like 20, 23% of people or companies that are changing prices, what's interesting is, you know, like, I think only about half of them did price increases. There's a lot of other companies or the rest of those companies are, some of them are actually decreasing prices. This is what I'm digging into right now. So there's definitely economic pressure to decrease, especially entry-level prices. So entry-level plans are getting a little bit more affordable, which is also an interesting trend. Obviously, companies like OpenAI and some of the larger infrastructure companies are competing heavily against each other are lowering prices as well because it's usually cost plus or some sort of variation of cost plus pricing. But again, like not every price change has to be a price increase. There's also, I've noticed that, so like more and more companies doing intro discounts, which is also interesting. So intro discounts meaning that they lower the price for new customers for typically some period of time. So, you know, 50% off for the first three months. Even Slack is doing this, but there's more and more companies doing intro discounts. It used to be think like QuickBooks used to do this all the time, especially like all the accounting software, because they know once you're in, you're not switching. So it's like whatever it costs to get somebody. But again, like intro discounts are interesting because it's different than doing freemium or a free trial. You typically get more time to develop those habits to use that software, which I think is suitable for quite a few companies. So I'm looking at this data right now. Again, once we publish the benchmark report, I'll have more insights, but those are sort of like some of the key trends there.
That's a big one. That one really surprises me too, because pricing going down, right? And you're thinking, typically speaking, they're going up and nothing crazy, right? Sometimes it's just 10% or a couple bucks here and there. And what you're seeing is that actually not only pricing going down, but also promo sort of entry. Let's just accelerate this acquisition motion and get them to try so they can buy, right? I think freemium and free trials have been around for a while, which is the lowest risk way of getting into a new product. But there's boundaries, right, in terms of time, or there's boundaries in terms of how much capability you get access to. But this is a little different. And I think you're really right on to point out that this is an acquisition strategy. It makes it easier to get into the product. The play is hopefully that when that expires, you're already hooked in and loving the new world with the product versus the old world without it. And then you're able to keep going. So one dangerous point thing about a 3-month half off or, you know, 6 months at a special introductory rate is something that there's a bit of a churn cliff that happens here, right? So I worked with a company and they lived and died on this intro rate. And one of the things is if you get hooked on it, because you're like, ooh, there's a bump in conversion and look at all these new deals coming in, it can sometimes lead to artificial or lower anchoring. And then after the 90 days or 30 days, whatever it is over, you may notice a blip in your drop-offs or in your churn and folks leaving, because when you do the intro rate, you're also opening the door for what I call price buyers, not value buyers.
Yeah,
right.
Very, very good point, Marcos.
Right,
so I actually have a story.
I want to hear it.
Going back to my Format days. So when Format got acquired, so we sold Format after, you know, I was there for about 3 years. The company that acquired Format, Zenfolio, was addicted. And I'm using this term literally. They were addicted to intro discounts. So they always had 50% off sale going on every single month. They would just literally update the month. You know, it's like September sale, October sale, but always 50% off, because as soon as they turned it off, their new revenue just dropped. It tanked. But then they had a churn issue because, again, like on renewal, when those customers had to pay full price, they don't want to pay full price. So to your point, again, like a lot of those customers were shopping around and they only bought in because it was 50% off and it was a deal, not because they were really interested in the solution or the value of the solution. And that's a very, very tricky, very slippery slope. It's a double-edged sword. You can increase your adoption or new customer acquisition, but again, like if you're losing most of those customers when the full rate kicks in, then I don't know if it's working. So it's definitely tricky. I think it works well for really sticky solutions. So accounting software, great. Again, like once you're on it, but again, like I'm with you on this one. This is a tricky, like, I don't know if I would recommend it.
It's super slippery. I would say, I think you're absolutely right. The stickier, the better. And I'll offer one more thing before we move on, which is you may have to double down on your onboarding and your CS, your customer success. And what I mean by that, you got to get them to value and you got to get them to do the right things in your software solution to create that stickiness. They got to hit some milestones, send that invoice, integrate that system, whatever it is, get to that point in order to take advantage. So if you are thinking about a promo or intro, I'd say be double down on that onboarding motion, on that customer success.
Yeah, it's almost like you're treating it as an extended trial. So you know, during that discount period, your discounted customers have longer period of time to try. So again, like you want to do everything to get them to adopt and you know create that stickiness with the product, because again, like that reduces the risk of churn.
100%. So all you guys thinking about there, a tactic that we're seeing in out there as part of the data and the research, I would say tread carefully. I think John would say the same. Last section here, I want to move forward to where we talk fast forward in the future. It's almost like the future happening now, which is AI and AI pricing, right? And I'm thinking about some of the things where they were starting to see companies beginning to gain some courage and try to monetize the AI. There's still a big chunk of them that are not monetizing. I want to hear your thoughts about that. But where do you see these guys going? Are there some trends you're seeing popping up here in the data? Let's talk about AI.
AI has been top of mind. We spent a lot of time looking at AI and how companies are pricing AI. We've run some surveys as well for people who are signing up our newsletter. We surveyed them. And based on just the survey results, it sounds like roughly about half of them are monetizing AI, so a little bit more than the pricing changes, but more than half, or like about half, are still thinking about it. So they've actually invested money into building AI capabilities over the last 12 months, but they're not making any more that they used to prior to that, which again, to me, is crazy. And I think it's even worse with AI because, as you know, Marcos, AI usually has costs associated with them. It's not like it's not cheap. Most of these companies are building on top of OpenAI, you know, like Google, Gemini, something, an infrastructure that has costs per usage. So the more their customers are using the AI features, the more it costs them. So it actually hits their margins, and yet they're not increasing prices or necessarily monetizing AI explicitly. So I think right now, it's been roughly a year since OpenAI has really disrupted the industry with ChatGPT. And there's been this gold rush of companies jumping on the bandwagon, adding all these AI features. I think right now we're at the point where a lot of them are now like, okay, now it's time to actually start thinking about monetization. So we've looked at, so like every company that we have in our data set that has monetized AI, just to see how they're doing this. And there's really like three ways that companies are doing it. One is either as an add-on. So they create an add-on, and this could be per seat add-on or usage-based add-on. Notion, for instance, charges per seat, and you can buy Notion AI by paying an extra $8 or $10 per seat to turn on the AI features. Algolia, search company, allows you to buy an add-on, but they charge per number of searches, or so again, it's usage-based. So add-ons is one type of AI pricing monetization that is quite prevalent. The other one is just incorporating it into your existing tiers. So if you have a good, better, best type of model where you have different plan tiers, including a free one, what we've noticed, a lot of companies will stick AI features into one of the existing plans. And it ranges. It ranges all the way from, let's give it to everybody, including the freemium plan, to just the, so like the premium middle tiers, to just enterprise. Depending on so like how, where they slot it, there's different monetization opportunities. To me, what this tells me is these companies are monetizing it based on the constraints that they have today. So again, like without investing in a new pricing model or new infrastructure, they have existing tiers. It's easy to insert AI and treat it like any other feature. With the add-ons, it's a little bit easy as well because they already charge per seat, or you know, with Algolia for usage. So it's sort of like an extension of what they do. But I think the real opportunity is with either by creating new products. Some companies are spinning up new products. Aha, the road mapping software is an example. They've created Aha Knowledge, which sort of like uses AI to parse through documents, which is a great multi-product strategy. In some cases, as you probably know, companies are doing outcome-based pricing. Intercom is the perfect example, but very few do it. So outcome-based pricing basically means, you know, you're charging based on some successful outcome. In case of Intercom, successful support resolution. I read an article last week that Salesforce is talking about changing their model from seat-based to conversation because they think over the next decade, AI will totally disrupt how CRM works. So I think we are going to see a lot more in terms of outcome or different type of model for AI pricing. But I think the state of the industry today is companies are basically leveraging their existing pricing infrastructure and billing software. So like somehow monetize AI. I don't think it's the optimal way of doing it. It's just the easiest way of doing it.
I think easy versus optimal is the key here from what you're seeing, right? I think the And by the way, there's just a lot of learning going on, right? So we're just sort of trying to figure this stuff out in terms of, you know, who wants to buy it. And so when you talk about integrating it into tiers, some are doing it everywhere, some are doing it in just a premium. Think about Box, right? Where they have Enterprise. Enterprise Plus includes AI. And what you're doing is you're giving it to the, you know, most complex and highest willingness to pay customers. Let's face it, right?
Right.
And so you kind of see where their tolerance is for paying it. And then you can sort of, you know, propagate from there as you learn. So this is a bit of a toe in the water. What's the temperature like? Learning phase. And so everything you're seeing out there, I want everybody to be careful. It's not necessarily the right way to price for AI. It's just what companies are doing to experiment, lean in, you know, see where the value is and see where that threshold of value exchange is. And then this will continue to evolve quite rapidly. So if you're thinking about something that's a little different, maybe against the grain, but you think it works for your value, I would say, you know, give it a test. Go for it, right? It's okay. There's no established rule just yet. I mean, you would agree, right, John? What you see?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. You know, like, I think AI is different than everything else we've done before in so many different ways. Companies are learning. We're sort of like in this learning phase. Like, how do you actually quantify the value that it generates and how do you convert it into dollar signs, right? So, but I think, you know, like the point about experimenting and you're like testing it is key, right? Like there's nothing stopping you from running these types of experiments. They're low risk and you want to get the feedback from customers. I think one of the biggest challenges that these companies are facing right now is around positioning of AI features. Because AI is such a overloaded buzzword right now that just because you add AI, it doesn't mean anything to anybody, right? Like in reality, it means something different for every single product. But how do you explain this quickly, you know, like on your homepage or your pricing page? So what you'll find these days on pricing pages, there's usually like a whole section, you know, like ClickUp or, you know, Rike. They have these sections on AI. It's like, turn on AI. By the way, you get this, right? But it's like, just saying AI doesn't really mean anything. So like, how do you even explain what you get? I think a lot of it comes down to like, experience. Like, I think sometimes it's even hard to articulate it in words. My recommendation would be like, experiment by giving people access, see where there's uptake, and then you can sort of like figure out where you put in your monetization gates. It's like, okay, this is bringing value. How do I monetize this? And then so like started experimenting with those.
That's right. Small steps first, right? And just kind of see and build from there. It does mean something different for everyone. And depending on the vertical and depending on if your AI is more, you know, complementary than, or maybe it's something that replaces something else. Maybe it's integral to your whole platform. Like depending on all those different various factors, it could take a different path in that experimentation. So I think it's folks keep testing, but I will say this, you know, the add-on approach, just like your story with format, is a nice little safe way to kind of see who buys it, who doesn't, and sort of ease your way into it. You could always add it as a promotional piece. You could always give it for something else like that year commitment. But add-ons tend to be that segue. I think that's why you see so much of it. And then from there, expanding. An add-on is just a great launch pad, if you will, for something new coming in. One more thing from an AI perspective. You were talking to a founder of an AI company right now, and he was saying, how should I price my AI tool? What would be your answer? I know what my answer would be, but what would be your answer to that founder?
It's a loaded question, Marcus.
I'm setting you up. I'm setting you up to fail, my man. No, because you're a product person, I'm a product person. The classic answer is, it depends, right? And that's...
So context, I think, is everything. The nature of the product, you know, like who your customers are. But I think, you know, like, companies that are starting from scratch, so they're AI first, they're not bogged down by historical pricing or historical subscriptions, have really the opportunity to like really, really disrupt monetization or like AI with monetization together. Outcome-based is always like the best. So like for pricing people, that's always like the best way to go, but it is hard. Outcome sometimes is not possible because of attribution. It's like you drove a certain outcome, but again, like how do you prove that it was your tool or your software that drove that outcome? I heard somebody mention AI agents that are priced based on Again, different outcomes. So like popular trend with AI agents right now is within sales. So acting as BDRs. And I think I heard somebody mention that again, like now they're starting to get priced more outcome-based. So, or not necessarily outcome, sometimes it's output. So output versus outcome, meaning that, you know, like instead of closing a deal, it drove a meeting, right? So again, like you closed a meeting. Booked a meeting. So, you know, like I think these companies that are like creating virtual or AI-based SDRs or BDRs are now starting to experiment with like, okay, instead of charging you based on, you know, like usage or per month fee, we'll charge you based on the number of meetings booked through this AI agent. But again, it's such a contextual question. It's really hard to sort of like give one universal answer to that question for me.
Yeah, I call it something, I use this term called distance to the goal. So everybody buys software to get to a goal at the end of the day. And the closer you are to the goal, the outcome, the more you can, you know, align to value, and even the more you can charge, frankly, or the willingness to pay gets clearer, the farther away from the goal, right, from outcome to maybe output, output to like input, input to even something else, it gets really hard to draw that line, and it gets harder for you to capture that value, right? So it's really difficult to jump all the way to the very end. I think you're right. I think outcome is ideal. People want it. It's just, again, really hard, fuzzy to nail down. It can get confusing on who's driving the value. And where there's confusion, you know, what Dan always says, right? A confused mind never buys. It's been around for a long time. You don't want to introduce a metric that is perfectly aligned and perfectly confusing to everybody, right? So I think there's something we have to be very careful about there, in my view.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Big home, let's take it back. AI pricing, the big do and the big don't. What do you say?
I think the big do is what we already discussed. It's like, don't be afraid to start testing and experimenting both with adoption and seeing how people use it, the value that they derive, but also like pricing it. Add-on, super simple way of, you know, like testing willingness to pay. I think with add-ons, my only caveat is you still want to create a path where they can experience it without committing, whether it's, you know, like a trial or something that again, like gives them a sense of like, this is what I'm getting, I think is key. In terms of like don'ts, I think companies are at this phase now where they have to be careful with overusing the term AI, because again, like I remember back in the day, big data used to be a big term.
I don't know if you remember those times, Marcos.
But it's like big data this, big data that, and you know, to the point where it's like just noise, and it doesn't actually help you sell or doesn't create improve the communication, or it just creates confusion. It's like, okay, AI, it's like whatever. So stop slapping AI on everything and, you know, like go back to the basics, like really, you know, talk about the value that you're creating, you know, whether it's, you know, more efficient way of booking meetings or et cetera. But again, like talk about the value instead of just saying we're AI driven, we're AI this, because again, like this is getting old already.
I like it. I like it, man. So it's all about, you know, testing the right thing and talking about the right things. I think you got it right on those key things there. Now, for my last question for you, man, I'm going to throw you a curveball. You've given us so much value and so much knowledge so far, but I got to know you as a human being. Sometimes I wonder if you are human because you just work so damn hard and so much. You're probably AI talking to me right now, right? No, I'm kidding, John. But I would love to ask you this question, man. I love everyone's response to this, which is, what was your favorite jam growing up? Your favorite song, the thing you could just listen to over and over again, gets you smiling, gets you going. What is it?
I've got to say Nirvana.
Oh,
Kurt Cobain. I, you know, growing up in the 90s, you know, like that was sort of like my go-to band.
Excellent. Like Teen Spirit, or that smells like Teen Spirit, that big jam, right? I love it, man. No, excellent. And I can see it now. I can see you getting motivated and working, you know, all day, all night, probably on things, man. John, I want to thank you for coming on today. And would you be willing to come back and share an update in the future?
Of course. We collect data, so we have fresh data all the time. So all kinds of insights that I'm always happy to talk about.
Highly, highly recommend. I read the insights all the time. For those out there who want to see what's going on in pricing pages, go visit Pricing SaaS. You got to grab their stuff. It's really good. It's real. You said 450, right? In the sample size. So it's a meaningful group.
All of these resources are free we make money through sponsorships. So we give away all the resources for free. There's a ton of resources. We also publish a weekly newsletter. So pricingsess.com, sign up.
And it's free. It's free, everybody, it's right? Free. That's a hard price to beat, man. No, John, thank you for coming on today. So team, that was John Kotovsky. I really, again, recommend his material. Also, take a lot of the lessons that he walked through today, not just how he launched pricing at Format, but also thinking through some of the lessons that he's seeing and the trends within changing your pricing and AI. Take it, get 1% better, and remember, stop guessing and start growing. Until next time.
Thank you and much love for listening to the Street Pricing Podcast with Marcos Rivera. We hope you enjoyed this episode and don't forget to like and subscribe. If you want to learn more about capturing value, pick up a copy of Street Pricing on Amazon. Until next time.